Okay, welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is April 26, 2017, and today we will be holding two work sessions. Before we get into the work sessions, let me check with staff and see what we have.
Okay, first up we'll have Senate Bill 5538, which is the budget bill for the Board of Tax Practitioners, and then we'll also be having a work session on public employees retirement system, the 2016 preliminary earnings crediting report.
Okay, so with that being said, I guess we'll get started, and we'll start off the first work session, which will be on House Bill 5538, which is Board of Tax Practitioners.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And we have under the meeting materials for the subcommittee is Senate Bill 5538 LFO recommendations. The budget for the Board of Tax Practitioner conservatively projects revenues at 3% less than the 2015-17 projected actuals. The projected ending fund balance is $188,980, and other funds is an equivalent to 4 months of operating expenditures. This budget represents a 15.9% reduction from the 15-17 legislatively approved budget and a 0% change from the 2017-19 adjusted current service level. The first package in the budget is 070 revenue shortfalls. This package decreases expenditures by $268,459 in other funds, just to account for some workload savings that was realized as a result of streamlining the agency operations and integrating a new IT licensing system. The budget reduces a vacant 1.0 compliance specialist position abolishes a 1.0 compliance specialist position, and then reduces one permanent full-time administrative specialist position to a part-time. So the total reduction in the package is 1.5 FTE. And then the last package 090, Analyst Adjustment. This package increases the ending balance by $64,435 in other funds, and that's to account for cost savings that have been realized in the current biennium, and we'll roll some of those savings over into the 17-19 biennium. Furthermore, based on the reduction in agency staffing and the relocation to a smaller office space, $2,000 has been reduced in out-of-state travel, and $34,000 has been reduced in facilities and rent. And then that is countered by adding $36,000 in limitation for IT professional services to adjust for the new technology contract. And that is the summary of the adjustments to the current service level.
Okay, Mr. Co-Chair.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to Senate Bill 5538.
The Co-Chair Smith moved the LFO recommendation to SB 558. Are there discussions? Anyone opposed? Motion is carried.
Okay, moving on to the key performance measures. The LFO recommendation is to approve the proposed new KPMs from the agencies for KPMs 1 through 6, and then delete the previous KPMs for numbers 1 through 4 and 6. The existing KPM for customer service is a KPM that's used statewide for all agencies, so the LFO recommendation is to keep this KPM and then renumber it as KPM number 7. And then additionally, LFO proposes a best practices KPM, which is used by most boards and commissions statewide. The KPM requires an annual assessment of 15 of the best practices for boards and commissions.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, so Mr. Co-Chair, I move LFO's recommendations on key performance measures.
Co-Chair Smith moved the LFO recommendations on key performance measures. Are there discussions? Is there any opposed?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this budget does contain a budget note. It's titled Report on Agency Operations and Finances. It says the Board of Tax Practitioners is directed to provide a general update on agency operations, as well as the current status of revenues, expenditures, and licensee counts to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means during the 2018 legislative session.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'd move LFO's recommendation on the budget note.
Coach Smith moved the LFO recommendation budget note. Are there any discussions? Any opposition?
Okay. The last item on our list is the amendment. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends a budget of $1,060,855 in other funds and three positions, which is 2.5 FTE, and this is reflected in the Dash 1 amendment.
Co-chair.
Oh, I move adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 5538. Mr. Co-chair.
Co-Chair Smith moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to SB 5538. Discussion. Are there any opposition?
All right. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 5538 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Smith has moved Senate Bill 553 as amended to the full committee with due pass recommendations. Are there any discussions? Norman.
Thank you, Chair Manning. So I'm going to be a no on this for a couple of reasons. So, I guess mainly just for the lawsuit they have defending their administrative rule. So I'll be a no on this one.
Are there any other? No. Representative?
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'll be a yes on the measure, but just to keep this in front of everybody's thinking, this agency still has about $600,000 in delinquent debt.
And it is noted, sir. Thank you. Any other questions, oppositions? Let the record reflect that Representative Nierman is a no, and it is passed by the majority vote. And we need to have a carrier for the bill. Okay, well, I guess the chair will carry the bill, and we need a House member to carry the bill then. Okay, all right, thank you. So the chair will be the carrier on the Senate side, and Representative Gomberg will be on the House side.
And a full.
And a full.
Sure.
Okay. So now we will open up a work session on public employee retirement systems, 2016 preliminary earnings crediting report, follow-up report. And right now, John, would you please?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, the materials are posted on OLIS for this work session. They include the agency's original report and the LFO analysis and recommendation. The Public Employees Retirement System on March 9th, 2017 reported to this subcommittee on its 2016 earnings crediting to the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund. The report made note of an overfunding of the contingency reserve fund by $345.9 million, but gave no indication of where the reserve fund should be deployed. This subcommittee recommended to the full Ways and Means Committee that the agency's report be acknowledged, but with the instruction that the PERS board report back to the Ways and Means on the board's specific recommendation as to which accounts the reserve funds would be deployed and the associated rationale. And today is the subject of this follow-up report. And Mr. Co-Chair, the agency is here to provide the report at the subcommittee's pleasure, or LFO could do it.
Okay, so which would be
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would respectfully ask that perhaps the professional staff kind of tee up the conversation, but I would like, with your permission, to use Mr. Rodman's appearance here as a target of opportunity to ask an unrelated question. It has to do with PERS, but not on this point. And if you would indulge me, I would welcome having him.
Absolutely. Sir, please have a seat, and for the record, please state your name.
Thank you, Chair Manning. For the record, my name is Steve Rodman, the Executive Director of the PERS.
Mr. Rodman, I'm about to ask you a very unfair question, and if you weave and dodge and don't answer it, I'll cut you a bunch of slack on it. But given that what I would consider sort of volatile atmosphere that surrounds any legislative discussion of PERS, I am starting to get calls from longtime PERS members who are quite interested in continuing their employment, but they see the presence of an emergency clause on 560. Senate Bill 560 has been referred out of committee and is now resting, awaiting us getting towards the end of the session. Do you have any comment on whether or not that emergency clause would stay on the bill? And the reason I ask is people are literally making decisions about whether or not to retire by next Monday. I will just share with you my predisposition is that to have an emergency clause on a bill of that magnitude is grotesquely unfair to members who would want to have some reasonable planning horizon to think about their retirement. And I would just ask you if you would be so kind as to opine within your ability to do so as an agency head to opine on the durability of that emergency clause.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, thank you actually for the opportunity to do so. The Senate Workforce Committee did move the Senate Bill 560 out of the committee, but amended it to remove the emergency clause when they sent it down to Ways and Means. So as it sits in Ways and Means now as amended, it does not have an emergency clause. There was a lot of discussion within Senate Workforce over the effect of that emergency clause on the perception of the operative terms of the bill. The bill itself and most of the amendments, I can't speak to all of them, there are dozens. Most of the amendments had specific operative dates of January 1 of 2018. So what that meant was, for example, if you were talking about the final average salary reduction to $100,000, that applied to salary paid after January 1 of 2018. The emergency clause was in there for a couple of reasons, one of which is the Supreme Court direct referral, which is common in most PERS legislation. The process to the Supreme Court starts when the bill becomes effective. So if you strip out the emergency clause, the lawsuit can't start until January 1. The other thing that I've been told is that the emergency clause is in there so that the agency can adopt rules to implement the provisions of the bill in time for its operative date. I haven't fleshed that completely out with DOJ, but we adopt rules all the time that have different effective dates than filing immediately. So I don't know that that's necessary for us. But those were kind of the two reasons stated for the emergency clauses having an existence within the bill. For those members,
let me just interrupt you and just clarify. But the emergency clause at this moment has been stripped out of the bill.
Correct.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
So the Workforce Committee was quite cognizant of the concern over the emergency clause, a subject of their hearing. I can't remember exactly what date, but I think it was a week ago Wednesday. Today is Wednesday, right? So it would have been 2 weeks ago, and spoke at length about the member concern. Our messaging around that has been, as we understand the court case, no legislation can reduce benefits that are accrued up to a point in time that the legislation comes into play. And therefore, any legislation cannot reduce what a member would get in retirement today, and they cannot, and the legislation does not reduce what a member might get tomorrow. Sorry, the member will still get more benefit tomorrow if they keep working. They just might get less more. So what do I mean by that? That 100,000 example, if it came into effect January 1 of 2018 and you were an employee making more than 100,000, you would get that no salary limitation would apply other than the ones in existence. The new salary limitation would not apply to your salary through 2017. The 100,000 limitation would apply on your salary in 18. So if you worked for the first 3 or 4 months in 2018, you'd get less of a benefit because your salary was restricted, but it's not like you would get less benefit for 2017 and all the time prior. To the extent that any of the legislation that is being considered would reduce the benefit you would get today, I think it violates the court's directive. So it would be unconstitutional, speaking as a layperson's understanding, not as a legislative counsel. So thank you for actually the opportunity for another forum in which to address this. Our phone staff, my staff and I, as we walk through the halls of this building, are accosted with the same concerns. So every opportunity we have to express the need to deliberately plan for your retirement rather than make a knee-jerk decision or an ill-considered decision, we encourage members to think through the consequences of their decision. And the legislation should not be driving that, certainly not get your application in by Friday.
Yeah. Thank you for your very comprehensive answer. And I think as of Monday, a very capable high school teacher will still be on the job. So thank you for your remarks. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence.
Should that teacher change his or her mind, Friday is the deadline because the first, you have to have your application in before the first, and the first is Monday.
Are there any other questions? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Manning. Have you the situation that you just described with basically proportionality over the course of the career, is that in writing someplace?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Marsh, it is the model we used to implement the 2013 legislation, which reduced the cost of living adjustment. You get 2% for the service of time prior to the legislation being effective and a reduced COLA for the service after that. That has not been challenged, but presumably it's not been challenged because it follows the court's directive. While the legislation may not exactly say that, I think the Workforce Committee was very clear in saying that the words in the bills are not the words that will come out of this process. And I think that allocation would be necessary to comply with the court's directives. So I would expect, if there is any legislation brought forward, it would reflect that proportionality. If not directly in the bill, then it would be in how we implement the bill to maintain the constitutional test that we think we need to meet.
Follow up. So would you be comfortable putting that statement in writing? It just seems
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Marsh, what we have, of course, are, I don't know if they're more or less lengthy than what I just went through, but we do have those talking points that our staff is using. The problem with putting it in writing, of course, is that we can't give legal advice, nor should we be in that position, which is only to say it could be misconstrued as that, because it's our understanding of how the courts, it is our understanding of how the court's mandate has to be followed. It's also our understanding of how the legislation should be structured, but we don't write the bill. You all do.
Right.
So it may be a little misleading to try to put out some sort of a guarantee or a definitive statement about it. As evasive or direct as Senator Johnson may think I was to her question, I'm trying to walk that line.
So one more question. Thank you. So are your talking points available online or available to, because I think we're all facing this question of trying to provide reasonable guidance to people who are inquiring.
We can, Co-Chair Manning, Representative Marsh, they are not currently, but we can make them.
I think that would be useful.
Senator? The other opportunity that I'm going to do for my constituent is to refer them to today's presentation on OLAS.
Good idea.
And if I may, too, whatever that Workforce Wednesday hearing was, it was the Wednesday, right, Marjorie? 2 weeks ago today, I would also refer them to that. It was quite an extensive conversation and assurances by both Chair Taylor and Vice Chair Canope.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Representative. LFO.
Mr. Co-Chair, perhaps it might be best at this time if the agency would present or their report. Is that?
Yes. Well, let's do that. We won't take up a lot of your time as the clock is ticking, so I would ask that if the committee will hold their questions, if any questions come out to finish up with this presentation, please begin.
Co-Chair Manning and members of the committee, we provided to you a report that is to the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee responding to the request as we understood it that emanated from this committee's direction. The PERS board met at their April meeting and considered the input from a number of stakeholders, including the governor, the co-chairs of the, the chair and vice chair of the Workforce Committee, the leaders of the Senate Republican Office, as well as a letter from Greg Hartman, the attorney on behalf of the PERS Coalition. Those are all in your packet as well and attached to the report. The PERS Coalition suggested that, the PERS board should do a proportionate allocation of the excess in the contingency reserve. That would basically return funds in proportion to the account balances that had generated the excess funding in the contingency reserve. Instead, what the PERS board did was follow the direction in the other stakeholders, the governor and the legislative folks that, weighed in, suggesting or giving input that the board should instead allocate all of the excess contingency reserve funding to the benefits and force reserve. Let me talk about practically what that does. You all have heard me present about how the PERS system is looked at in its financial status, benefits, contributions, earnings, the formula that we assess. Within that formula, the contingency reserve is not counted. It is money that is held off to the side because, frankly, the actuaries don't know what that money will be used for. So by taking money out of that reserve and putting it into the formula, that balances the equation differently. By putting it all within the benefits and force reserve, it all goes into basically the E or earnings component of that formula, meaning contributions don't have to go up as much because there's $350 million that doesn't have to be brought in and has no effect on the benefits that are paid to members. So it was just bringing money out, kind of off the books into that formula, making the balance a little better on the side of the funding of those benefits. By putting it in the benefits and force reserve also, it then gets proportionally allocated to all employers when we do their rates. So every employer gets a little slice of the benefit of that. When I say a little slice, the benefits and force reserve is some $20 billion. And so $350 million more in that is certainly not inconsequential. It's hard to say $350 million is inconsequential, but it is not necessarily a game changer as far as the funding of this system goes. But it is a contribution towards reduction in the rates that employers will have to pay going forward. So that was the action that the board took. We were asked by this committee to come back and report on the board's action before that final allocation is made. And that is what I've now done.
Okay. Other questions?
Okay. I guess it begs the question that is unanswerable at this moment, but the treatment of reserves going forward and whether or not the PERS board is taking a policy position statement, or I think it's unusual that you'd accumulated this much unallocated reserve. Maybe I could be wrong on that. I'm just trying to figure out. It seemed as though we had come to sort of a denouement in this discussion where it was a surprise to people that there was that much money in the reserves, and I don't know how you're going to treat it going forward.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, there is a long and tortured history that I will try to avoid.
That's what I was worried about.
Yeah, so let me cut right to the chase, which is that a year ago, the PERS board decided a policy, which is to say the funding level of the contingency reserve should be 0.25% of accrued liability. That is what drove then the reduction in the contingency reserve down to that level. So that was the first time we actually had the board opining on what the policy position should be. LFO's report notes there isn't a separate writing on that. That's why there are that we refer back to the board minutes as record of what the board has decided. So that is what the minutes reflect. That is the policy of the board going forward. Is 0.25% of accrued liability the right number, the wrong number? Is it too high or is it too low? It's frankly a number. The result of that is about $190 million in the contingency reserve. When you look at the history of the allocation and use of the reserve, which again, LFO was helpful in providing in their report, you see there's been a number of puts and takes since this reserve was was reconstituted in 2003, and you'll also see, Senator Johnson, to your point, the balance in the reserve has fluctuated greatly. Part of that has to do with the broader context. You say that people were surprised we had so much in the reserve. Don't forget, a few short years ago, we're facing a Supreme Court decision on benefit reductions, which could have triggered more in responsibility for liability, recouping payments that we would have had to fund back to members. So we kept the reserve at a relatively high level until the Supreme Court decision was resolved. Once that was resolved, we came back around to the funding level, and that led us to where we're at today.
Thank you.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may not frame this right, but we put $345 million. How much did that reduce the unfunded liability?
$345
million. But as a
percentage?
So our $22 billion, I think, is the number I keep hearing. Is that number still what the official number is?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, the $22 billion or so is based on the 2015 valuation. So that is the last official number that we have. And the $350 million now should the board be able to proceed with this reallocation, the $350 million will come back on the books for the 2017 valuation, because we'll put the money back in this year if the board is allowed to proceed. That means when the actuaries look at the relative balance of assets and liabilities for the end of 2017, there'll be $350 million more to the good. That $22 billion was a point in time in 2015. It's different every day since. But that's the last time they took a number. So that $350 million is a reduction dollar for dollar, but that $22 billion has changed in the intervening time. What did the stock market do today? How did our investment returns do? Those sorts of fluctuations drive that number.
So a couple of follow-ups, if you don't mind. And now I'm going to go blank a little bit. When do we get the next report? You say this is based on 2015.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, we do valuations every calendar year. So we will do a valuation for 2016. That will be done this summer. And that is what we call an advisory valuation. What that does is look at, again, that formula, but it is not used to set employer rates. Instead, it's used to test what we call experience and assumptions. So by that I mean, in that 2016 valuation, do we have the right mortality assumptions? Do we have the right assumed rate for the system? Is our observed experience about our membership demographics accurate or not? That is all tested in the 16 valuation. We'll have another number this summer that says, here's what the 16 unfunded liability is. Then we'll do it again in 17 at the end of the calendar year, and that 17 valuation result will be used to set employer rates for July 1, 2019. So just we cycle more through this every year. Every other year, it means we change rates.
I noticed our percent of funding that's somewhat nationally recognized is decreasing rapidly in the last, I think, three reports. So anyway, I just want to thank you for your clear and concise answers to questions that may be really difficult. But I want to keep focusing on our unfunded liability, because I don't see us doing much to help the funding. And the 345 was kind of a shell game in the fact that it was there and then brought back. So, and I appreciate you didn't use it to increase our yield artificially. So thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I think Mr. Co-Chair. In my E-Trade account, there's a management fee, a maintenance fee that I'm able or obligated to pay to be part of E-Trade. Has the PERS board ever looked at establishing an account maintenance fee that perhaps both employers and employees would contribute to, that then can be used to offset a portion of the unfunded liability?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, we have not. The earnings that are credited to individual member and employer accounts are net of those costs. So when we credit as we did 7+%, that crediting is reduced by the expenses that we incurred and the Treasury incurred in administering the system. Were we to charge a fee instead, then our costs would be paid by that fee and earnings would go up as a result, because we wouldn't be taking the money. So to me, it's kind of, do you take it off the earnings or do you take it as an account fee and then earnings go up and net-net you're in the same place?
I don't understand that. How would they be in the same place?
So
it's an additional injection of cash.
It's an additional injection of cash that offsets the earnings that we otherwise would be taking that from. So I can't do the math in my head quickly enough, but let's say our fees and Treasury's fees are some 1%. So if members and employers paid us an account maintenance fee that equaled 1% of the fund's return, then instead of crediting 7%, having taken that 1% off, we credit 8%, but we would have taken the 1% in fees. So in terms of the system itself, it's a closed system. The investments yield earnings, and expenses are taken off of those earnings. What's left is credited to fund the system. I'm not sure where I guess the maintenance fee would come from. Would it come from salary that's paid to members? Would it come from employer contributions? All those are questions I'd need to understand better to know how that's additive to the assets available to pay benefits.
What if it came from the members directly and separately?
We don't have a construct for that, and that is all. That is only to say, I haven't been presented or thought through the results of that. I fear the delinquencies that you've referenced with the Board of Accountancy would be dwarfed by our collection efforts, because I don't know how I would compel someone to give me an individual member to give me that money.
If it was an existing employee, couldn't you do it through payroll deduction?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair
Smith. I'm not advocating for this. I'm just factually asking questions.
I'm trying to work through it as you're posing me the questions, because, like I say, we haven't thought about that. To me, that's an additional member contribution. So,
well, let's do this. Let's, because it's not fair to hit you cold on that. Why don't John and the co-chairs and I think through that a little bit and just send that to you and perhaps a written memo, and then that way you can, you know, have your professional staff look at it as well.
Okay.
So we got to get real briefly.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out of the earnings report on public employees retirement system, the preliminary earnings, it reads $396.6 million in calendar year investment expenses in brokerage commissions, $2.4 million in administrative expenses directed by the Oregon Investment Council, $9.9 million in state treasury expenses, and $42.7 million for PERS agency operational expenses. That's out of, I think, earnings of $4.6 billion. So
I know that there are a number of questions, but I want to be respectful of everybody's time. So
nope, I'll hold up, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So I guess we better move on. Okay.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I think it's important to note for the record a key facet that's lost when discussing the UAL. And while the UAL, the current 2015 UAL, might be $22 billion, there is $5.6 billion of site account money that offsets that amount that's in trust that can only be used to prepay employer rates. So the actual UAL is in the neighborhood of $16.4 billion. So the $22 billion needs to be qualified in those terms. If I may, Mr. Co-Chair, the LFO, getting back to this follow-up report by the agency, looked at two questions. The first question is the allocation of contingency reserves to just this benefit and in force account appropriate, and is the methodology for setting the reserve balance reasonable? Those were the two questions LFO considered when doing an analysis of the board's report. And LFO notes on the allocation to just the one account that this is not historically the practice of what the PERS board has done in the past. In the past, it's been a proportionate allocation. And so in the LFO analysis is a table that compares the two side by side. And we would just note that there, of course, would be by a single allocation versus a proportionate allocation. The importance there is that proportionate means that the funds are credited back to where they originally arose from. And so that there would be a disparity between this allocation recommended by the board and that proportional allocation. The other thing to note is, from LFO's perspective, is that there is certain accounts, especially the Tier 1 Rate Guarantee Reserve, whose balance has fluctuated significantly, would not receive any crediting, and that there has been times when this contingency reserve has had to make that fund solvent. So again, there's a difference in the approaches here. On the other question, as to the appropriateness of the contingency reserve balance, the methodology that the board adopted was 0.25% of accrued liabilities. And the LFO notes in our analysis that this is an interesting approach because that would mean that in periods of high accrued liability, the contingency reserve target balance would increase, and in periods of low accrued liability, the reserve balance would decrease. And this seems at odds with the underlying rationale of a contingency reserve fund. For example, right now, with a high UAL is when you would want to use, in theory, contingency reserve funds to inject funds into the actuarial equation, have them counted for, lower the UAL and lower employer contribution rates. So with this, Mr. Co-Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office would recommend the acknowledging receipt of the report, but with instructions that the PERS board reevaluate the statutory requirements related to an adequately funded contingency reserve balance. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, I'm ready to make a motion, but I have one more question, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
All right, thank you, Mr. Has the PERS board, I'm sure they have they reviewed the amortization period that's set? And have they determined if it's appropriate? What's that length of time that we run our amortization schedule?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, the answer is yes. That's one of the things, that's one of the methods and assumptions that is reviewed every 2 years. So that will be reviewed again for the 2016 valuation. For Tier 1 and Tier 2 liabilities, we amortize over 20 years. For OPSERP liabilities, we amortize over 16 years. And then we also have some health insurance-related accounts that have a much smaller, shorter amortization period.
Would it be possible for us to see if on the 20-year and the 16-year, if we say bump the 16 to 20 and the 20 to 25, what that would mean?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, the answer is yes. There's analysis that Legislative Fiscal actually asked us to to refresh for this legislative session, which looks at the 20, so it doesn't do exactly what you asked.
Okay.
What it looks at it is the combined unfunded liability, what does 25 and what does 30 years look like?
Okay.
So I will tell you, if I may preview the results of that, the 25 and 30 are both extend the period of time that the UAL increases because you're not making your minimum payment. So you get into what's called negative amortization, that the debt grows faster than you're retiring it. So as a consequence, in a 30-year amortization, you dig a deeper hole for 20 years before you actually start decreasing the balance. The 16-year on OPSERP, OPSERP is so small in relative terms, it's only the rate on it is only 1.27% of payroll. As opposed to the big 16% of payroll that the Tier 1, Tier 2 UAL is. So the shorter amortization period, if you link 16 to 20, it's not going to make that much difference.
So let me flip that question. Can we take a look at, let's reverse the thought pattern and say, okay, if we're in a hole, why don't we get out of this hole as quick as possible?
Yeah.
What would it be if we went from, say, 16 to 12 and from 20 down to 15?
So I'll use the word angst that is being created already by the increase in PERS obligations. Remember, we've got several more biennia before we even clear the rate collar.
So let me give an example why I share this. I remember being this poor college guy, came out of school with debt, and had to make the decision, how long am I going to take to get out of debt? Now, I could have put it out over 10 years, or I could say, you know what, I'm going to keep that crummy little car with the broken window, and I'm not going to buy this, not buy that, and get out in 2 to 3 years and be all in on getting out of debt. And so I think there might be some merit in us at least understanding if we were all in to get out of debt and we shortened that time, what would it mean to us? I don't finance homes now over 10 years. So get in, get out.
I have to, Senator Johnson has a question. She...
I do not. When you get to the good of the order right before adjournment, I have a thought.
Okay.
So we need a motion.
Yeah. Are there any other questions before we go? Yes.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, I move we accept LFO's recommendation as presented to us.
Co-Chair Smith has moved that we accept LFO's recommendation as presented to us. Are there any further discussion? Any objections? Motion carries, and we need a carrier to the floor. Senator Borg, would you be interested,
sure.
Sir? And good Senator Borg will be the carrier on the bill. Thank you.
Just make sure you remind me.
we'll remind you.
This is just going to full committee.
Yeah, so going to full committee. Yep, going to full committee. Okay, and we will remind you, sir. Okay. Thank you very much,
sir.
If there are no further discussions,
no,
Senator.
Not with Mr. Rodman. But, colleagues, it appears that the phone switchover may be much worse than we were told yesterday. The help desk apparently cannot triage the urgency of requests for assistance. Hearing impaired individuals remain at a huge disadvantage, and some mission critical users are opting for cell phones rather than dealing with the music project. I would respectfully request of the committee co-chairs that this committee hold the state CIO and DAS responsible for regular reports on the status of the restart and a more in-depth discussion of the problems. The coverage yesterday appears to be grossly superficial.
Thank you, Senator, for that. John, got that? Mr. Co-Chair?
Yep, sounds like we're going to have follow-up conversations.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
I guess we need to do it sooner than later, so as time prevents, we get these holes in
phones.
Then we need to move forward on this as quick as possible. This is very important.
Well, my point is that frequently bad news is unveiled at these committees. Everybody gets past it and goes, well, that's over. Those guys are off our back. I think we need to stay on their back. We are paying for a phone system right now. We're paying for a dead phone system that isn't working. I don't know what the accrued costs are. And I'm dissatisfied with the presentation from yesterday that suggested this is going to be up in a week. If it's up in a week, they're back here telling us that it's up.
Absolutely.
Very loud and clear.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Co-Chair Manning. I would just add to that. I think we should ask them for data as to the users who were first in the queue. You know, they started installing a year ago. Let's find out if it's actually working for people. It sounds like in some cases it's not because they're already using cell phones. But let's, if we could find out if that is a significant widespread problem. Before we move forward with the rest of the system, it seems like that would be valuable.
Okay.
I don't know if we can give instruction or simply ask for that information.
Thank you, Representative Marsh. Judging from the dialogue that we just had, LFO, did you get those notes there? I think we want to be very specific when they come back and have hardcore data for us to look at. Sometimes there is a phrase that we used to use in the military, got bad news and more bad news. Mm-hmm. The bad news is the baby's ugly, and the more bad news is the baby's yours. So if they own it, then they own it then. So there's nothing further. There's nothing further. We will adjourn for today, and we will reconvene tomorrow, 1500, 3 o'clock, civilian time, and we are adjourned. Thank you, Michael.
And the other one was hurt.
And we are adjourned. Thank you, Michael.
And the other one was hurt.
Time.